Chapter 16. Love Bombing. In 1931, one of the worst years of the Great Depression, a young couple in a rural Indiana town had their first and only child. Scarred by the loss of their farmland and the ravages of World War II, they raised their son in a shack without running water. The mother educated her son as best she could. He showed empathy at a young age for African Americans. He read voraciously, showing an early interest in Gandhi and religion. He argued with his father over race, and did not speak to him for many years after he refused to let him bring a black friend into their house. In 1948, he graduated from high school with honors. At Indiana University in Bloomington, he was moved by a speech from former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt about the suffering of black Americans. His name was Jim Jones. Jones married and moved first to Northern California, and then to San Francisco with his wife to start a church. He called it the People's Temple. Jones believed he was the leader of a socialist revolution. He warned of nuclear war and claimed black people would be put in concentration camps. He became a hugely charismatic preacher among African Americans, the disaffiliated poor, and young transplants to the city looking for community. Scenes from the era show a remarkably large and diverse congregation smiling and singing. The People's Temple grew and provided services. Jones cultivated two progressive San Francisco politicians, George Moscone and Willie Brown, and mobilized people to volunteer for their campaigns. Jones had a complicated relationship to race and religion. He adopted several children of different races, naming his African-American son Jim Jones Jr. But in 2012, Jim Jones Jr. described his father manipulating black people by giving him special treatment compared to Jones's other adopted and biological children. Jim Jones Sr. sometimes referred to himself as mixed, Indian, or black, and appeared to have believed he was a reincarnation of an African-American spiritual leader who himself claimed to be Jesus Christ reborn. But Jones became an atheist who rejected religion, including Christianity, as oppressive, and became an apocalyptic Marxist. He ridiculed the notion of God and heaven. He was hedonistic and cruel. Jones coerced young congregants into sex, stole money from African-American families, and took both amphetamines and barbiturates. While Jones thought globally, he acted locally. His son and a San Francisco historian believed he stole the mayoral election from Moscone in 1975. Historian David Talbot, founder of the progressive website Salon, points to evidence that Jones committed sufficient voter fraud to account for Moscone's narrow 4,443-vote margin of victory. "We loaded up all 13 of our buses with maybe 70 people on each bus, and we had those buses rolling nonstop up and down the coast into San Francisco the day before the election," said Jones Jr. "Could we have been the force that tipped the election to Moscone? Absolutely, slam dunk. He only won by 4,000 votes. When federal investigators looked into fraud claims 3 years later, they discovered that all of the records were missing from the city of San Francisco's registrar of voters. Jones also boasted of providing Moscone with black women from his congregation for sex. One time, Moscone, drunk and accompanied by a young black woman whom the politician had kindly agreed to drive home, crashed into another car. Another time, Moscone and Willie Brown were with a black woman in an alley at 2 a.m. at some restaurant in North Beach, said a local bar owner. State legislator John Burton was part of that gang, too. They were all using marijuana and cocaine. Said Jones Jr., Moscone would always be there at temple parties with a cocktail in his hand and doing some ass-grabbing. A temple member overheard Jones speaking to Moscone the day after one of those parties, saying, "I want to let you know that the young lady you went off with is underage," adding, Now don't worry, Mayor, we'll take care of you, because we know that you'll take care of us. Afterward, Moscone made Jones the chairman of the powerful San Francisco Housing Commission. Jones cultivated progressives with money and favors. He made large donations to the ACLU, the NAACP, and United Farm Workers. Jones and Moscone met privately with vice presidential candidate Walter Mondale on a campaign plane a few days before the 1976 presidential election, and Mondale praised People's Temple shortly afterward. Jones met with First Lady Rosalynn Carter several times. Governor Jerry Brown praised Jones. Glide Memorial Church's Reverend Cecil Williams loved Jones. There is a photo from 1977 of a smiling Williams awarding Jones the church's Martin Luther King Jr. Award. Jones used his perch as chairman of the Housing Commission to fight for housing for the poor. He tried to use eminent domain to acquire the International Hotel, a single-resident occupancy hotel. After a court sided with the hotel's owner, Jones mobilized 7,000 protesters to picket it. By mid-January 1977, the situation had become heated. There were rumors that protesters inside the building were armed with guns and Molotov cocktails. Jones lost the legal battle in 1977, and the tenants were evicted. But the drama was a publicity victory for Jones, which burnished his image as a white savior. A conservative member of the Board of Supervisors, who was defeated in the mayoral election by Moscone, accused the new mayor, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the rest of the city establishment of being blind to Jones's extremism. "There's no radical plot in San Francisco," insisted Moscone in response. "There's no one I've appointed to any city position whom I regard as radical or extremist." Willie Brown, a powerful state legislator from 1964 to 1995, before becoming mayor in 1996, seemed oblivious to Jones's hucksterism and demagoguery, notes a historian. Brown was master of ceremonies at a dinner for Jones in the fall of 1976, attended by an adulatory crowd of the rich and powerful, including Governor Jerry Brown. "Let me present to you a combination of Martin King, Angela Davis, Albert Einstein, Chairman Mao," he said to loud applause. And yet Jones was contemptuous of Brown, even as Brown did Jones more and more favors. Jones mocked Brown for his designer suits, sports cars, and women. Once, while Brown was addressing the congregation and Jones was seated on stage behind him, Jones flipped his middle finger up to mock him. San Francisco's establishment stood by Jones even after a California magazine, New West, owned by Rupert Murdoch, published an exposé of Jones's beatings of temple members and financial abuses in August 1977. The article was written by a San Francisco Chronicle reporter and was meant for the Chronicle to publish. But the newspaper killed the story because it didn't want to alienate Jones, whom it viewed as central to its plans to expand the Chronicle's circulation in the heavily African-American Fillmore district. Jones also managed to avoid investigation and prosecution, in part by getting the district attorney to hire as deputy district attorney Jones's longtime attorney and confidant. Progressives defended Jones against the New West article. At a rally in the summer of 1977, Willie Brown said, "When somebody like Jim Jones comes on the scene, that absolutely scares the hell out of most everybody occupying positions of power in the system." Angela Davis sent a radio message broadcast over the cult's compound, Jonestown, in Guyana. "I know you're in a very difficult situation right now," she said, "and there is a very profound conspiracy designed to destroy the contributions which you have made to the struggle." After visiting Jonestown, the attorney to the Black Panthers said, "I have seen paradise." Harvey Milk, too, was tarnished by his association with Jones. In the fall of 1977, Milk wrote to President Carter's Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, requesting that Social Security checks be sent to elderly temple members in Guyana. People's Temple, wrote Milk, has established a beautiful retirement community in Guyana. In truth, the cult was disintegrating. Jones separated families and lovers, pitted relatives against each other, and forced neighbors to inform on each other. Jones sent people who violated the rules to solitary confinement in the box, an underground cubicle where people were held as prisoners for days on end. Others were drugged. Progressives who had spent 30 years fighting to close prisons and mental hospitals found themselves praising a man who had reproduced their worst practices. In November 1978, a Bay Area congressman flew to Guyana to investigate human rights violations at Jonestown with NBC News. Jones gave the delegation a formal reception at Jonestown. A temple member surreptitiously passed a note to one of the delegation members, saying he and another member wanted to escape. They fled the next day after a temple member tried to stab the congressman. Jones didn't prevent them from leaving, but then sent gunmen to fire machine guns at the delegation at the airport, killing the congressman and four others. A few hours later, 907 inhabitants of Jonestown drank Flavor Aid laced with cyanide and died. Two-thirds of the victims were African-American, and one-third were children. Jones had told them that if they didn't drink it, they would be killed by invading soldiers from a shadowy global military conspiracy intent on imposing fascism and torturing children. As people started crying in grief, Jones scolded them. "Stop these hysterics," he said. "This is not the way for people who are socialists or communists to die." Jones's wife protested the murder of children and had to be forcibly restrained. "We didn't commit suicide," said Jones in a tape recording. "We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world." Few were as stained by Jonestown as Willie Brown and George Moscone. Even as the bloated bodies of the dead were removed from the jungle and the wounded were airlifted by the U.S. Air Force to hospitals in the United States, wrote a historian, Brown said he had no regrets over his association with Jones. "They repeatedly disavowed responsibility." Said Moscone, "It's clear that if there was a sinister plan, then we were taken in. But I'm not taking any responsibility. It's not mine to shoulder." After Moscone and Milk were killed, 1 week later, San Franciscans and other Americans wondered if something fundamentally was wrong with one of the world's great cities. "There must be something evil out there," a visitor from San Francisco was told by a person hearing the news of Jonestown in Washington, D.C. "It's crazy, it's sick," said another person. A San Francisco Examiner columnist described San Francisco as a city where tolerance deteriorates into license, a town without a norm. Leading progressives were blind to the reality of the People's Temple and Jonestown for the same reason cult members were attracted to it: the intense commitment to caring and the redefinition of fairness, liberty, sanctity, authority, and loyalty around victims. The heavy focus on caring and the authority given to the victims, as represented by Jones, left progressives unable to see Jones's behavior. And the very creation of Jonestown as something deeply problematic and ultimately a violation of caring. At every stage in its existence, People's Temple outreach programs really did practice what Jones preached, wrote a historian. Needy people were served. Outcasts from every corner of the community were warmly welcomed. Yet no matter how many people were fed, clothed, helped to find jobs, or rescued from drug addiction by temple programs, Jim Jones ached for all those who still were not. Jones and the temple preyed on compassionate people who were also psychologically and spiritually lost angst-ridden, and concerned about their social status. Cult members often recruit people by convincing them that they are loved and that the cult leader can answer all the important questions they have. Cult recruiters have sometimes used love bombing, the showering of affection on the newcomer, as a recruitment strategy on college campuses, even waiting outside counseling centers to target troubled students. After Jonestown, progressives in the Bay Area sought to distance themselves from cult members. Joining a cult, argued psychologists, was a way for young people to save themselves from the terror associated with the increasing responsibilities and the progressive independence involved in maturing. Such people were mentally impaired, they argued, and often suffered psychotic disorder, which made them less tolerant of moral ambiguity and more in need of moral absolutes. But cults are much more common in progressive, secular places like the West Coast than in more traditional and conservative religious places. Researchers find that secularization stimulates the growth of cults where the conventional churches are weakest, including in the San Francisco Bay Area. In 1980, less than 2 years after Jonestown, more than half of all high school students in the San Francisco Bay Area reported at least one recruiting attempt by a cult member, and 40% reported at least three contacts. The relatively conservative values of voters in places like Miami, Houston, and Phoenix may explain why those cities have lower rates of homelessness than San Francisco, Seattle, and Los Angeles. Adherents to traditional religion tend to be more conservative and favor policies that reduce homelessness, such as banning public camping, defecation, and drug use, and using more mandatory drug and psychiatric treatment. Indeed, in 2018, scientists found that measures of religiosity can help explain significant variation in unsheltered homelessness in warm places. Concluded the researchers, culture or variation in service delivery may play an important role. Victimology appears to be rising as traditional religions are declining. Social scientists had for many years viewed the United States as a possible exception to the broad trend of secularization in other developed nations. But today it appears that the United States is secularizing like other nations, even as it remains more religious than many nations in Europe. In 2021, fewer than 50% of Americans belong to a house of worship. The decline of traditional religion has allowed for the rise of untraditional ones. Unlike traditional religions, many untraditional religions are largely invisible to the people who hold them most strongly. A secular religion like victimology is powerful because it meets the contemporary psychological, social, and spiritual needs of its believers, but also because it appears obvious, not ideological to them. Advocates of centering victims, giving them special rights, and allowing them to behave in ways that undermine city life, don't believe, in my experience, that they are adherents to a new religion, but rather that they are more compassionate and more moral than those who hold more traditional views. The treatment of victims as sacred and thus good occurs outside of the United States to equally destructive and degrading effect. In 1979, just a few months after Jonestown, a fundamentalist Islamic faction overthrew the government of Iran, winning support from progressives around the world, including Michel Foucault. He believed it was a triumph of the victims of Western colonialism and wrote magazine articles praising the new regime. Again and again, noted his biographer, he went out of his way to stress that the religious opponents of the Shah were not, as they were often glibly portrayed in the Western media, fanatics. The mullahs struck him as creditable megaphones for the popular will, who promised a new political spirituality. But within weeks of taking power, the mullahs' firing squads were executing gay people. After Dan White had shot and killed Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk on November 27, 1978, it fell to Supervisor Dianne Feinstein, President of the Board of Supervisors, to inform the public of the horrible news. Footage of her press conference can be seen in a powerful documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk. As President of the Board of Supervisors, she said, voice trembling, it is my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed. Jesus Christ, a man shouts. A woman's cry can be heard. The suspect, said Feinstein, is Supervisor Dan White. That night, tens of thousands of people took to the street holding candles, marching quietly toward Civic Center Plaza in one of the most moving and powerful demonstrations ever captured on film. At the time of the assassinations, Feinstein had felt her career in politics was over. It seemed clear to her, noted historian David Talbot, that she was not the leader that San Francisco wanted. Too starched, too middle of the road, too goody-goody. For example, Feinstein had wanted to clean up the Tenderloin, the city's drugged-out red light district. But Reverend Cecil Williams of Glide Memorial Church felt she was blaming the victim when she extolled the virtues of good hygiene and hard work to the homeless. If they had a place to get cleaned up, he said, most of them would get cleaned up. A few weeks before the assassinations, Feinstein had been trekking in Nepal, where she caught a bad intestinal illness. After she recovered, she decided to announce her resignation from politics on her return to San Francisco. I was firmly convinced that I was not electable as mayor, she said later. But now, with Milk and Moscone dead, she was mayor, and staring out over the crowd at City Center, preparing to give a speech. Feinstein told the crowd that she would make sure, as mayor, that San Francisco would continue to seek human rights, love, and understanding. She received the loud and warm applause that San Francisco audiences had never given her before. When I am really in crisis, she said later, things are much clearer to me. I move in a regular way, and can just sustain myself through the crisis. I needed that ability when I became mayor because the city was falling apart. Feinstein took a balanced approach. She appointed a progressive to replace Milk, seeking to affirm the will of the people who had elected him. Dianne never had a good relationship with Harvey Milk, said the Milk ally whom Feinstein appointed as supervisor to replace him. Her homosexuals were not his homosexuals, but very much to her credit, she put all that aside when she appointed me. Feinstein also increased funding for the police. I believe safety is the first thing you need to guarantee as mayor, she said. Feinstein rose to the challenge of the AIDS crisis. When it hit in the early 1980s, many believed it would set back the gay rights struggle, but instead it propelled it forward. Coming out of the closet went from being a nice thing to do to becoming a precondition for building the popular support for funding research and treatment. When Supervisor Harry Britt in 1982 asked Feinstein what should be funded, she said, "Fund everything." Said Britt, "She spent more time visiting AIDS patients in hospitals than I did. She was a giver. She was a very compassionate person. I don't want to say queenly because that sounds very negative, but she was a good queen." Feinstein proved to be the best possible leader for the crisis, concluded Talbot. San Francisco in November 1978 was a broken vessel on a dark sea. When deliverance finally came, San Francisco owed it large part to an unlikely leader. The reason, said Talbot, was that after the tumult of the 60s and 70s, San Franciscans needed a grown-up. That was then. Since the beginning of the new century, moderate Democrats have seen their power decline against progressive Democrats in San Francisco and around the country. Even when moderates are in charge, progressives have exercised their powers in other ways. Progressive members of the Seattle City Council, Los Angeles City Council, and San Francisco Board of Supervisors and other political officials, often with the significant support from nonprofit activists funded by local governments, have attacked mayors as uncaring. Growing progressive power culminated in the election of Chesa Boudin in 2019, the Seattle Capitol Hill Occupied protest of 2020, and demands that the homeless, mentally ill, and substance abusers be immune from prosecution in 2021. It's true that moderate Democrats control the executive branches of the local, state, and federal governments, but they have little to speak of as an agenda beyond being less radical than the radical left. Progressives have, by contrast, a full agenda: Medicare for all, Green New Deal, and sweeping criminal justice reforms, including defunding the police, de-incarceration, and drug legalization. Progressives have been on the rise in San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, and nationally, and openly stand in opposition to the more moderate members of the Democratic Party. While the mayors of Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles are all ostensibly moderate, their agendas have either been progressive or a response to progressive demands on harm reduction, housing first, and criminal justice. In 2021, the San Francisco School Board voted to strip Dianne Feinstein's name from an elementary school. Her crime was for allegedly replacing the Confederate flag in an historical flags exhibit in 1981 after it had been temporarily removed. In truth, Feinstein had agreed to replace the flag with one representing Union soldiers. But that didn't appear to matter much to anyone. Everybody seemed to understand that the progressive members of the San Francisco School Board in 2021 were targeting Feinstein for her moderation today, not for her policy toward flag exhibits 40 years ago. Over the decades, historians have debunked many of Foucault's claims, including around mental illness in Europe, but we can also fruitfully employ his ideas, particularly about the power of language to manipulate our ways of thinking and feeling. I would like to know the ways in which our bodies, our daily behavior, our sexual behavior, our desire, our scientific and theoretical discourses, he said, are linked with several systems of power, which are themselves linked with one another. This started with language. Study the power mechanisms at work in our speech and our society, he advised. Consider the power mechanisms at work in the discourses of homelessness and victimology. The demand that we not enforce laws against people defined as victims is an attack on a foundational principle of our democracy, equal justice under the law. What is being proposed is fundamentally unequal justice, or perhaps a kind of revenge, something that sociologists detect in the sacralization of victims. Holding the victim of an offense in higher regard can be a way of reversing the harmful effects of the offense, and even a way of punishing the offender, since one is rewarding the person the offender wanted to harm or punish, wrote two scholars. And if victimhood is a virtue, privilege is a vice. As soon as you use the word homeless, you find yourself trapped within a powerful discourse, one that manipulates our thinking and feelings. The people that my staff and I interact with every day outside of our office in Berkeley may or may not have homes, relatives, or friends with homes where they could stay. They may or may not have access to shelter. Some do and some don't. But what they all have in common is usually some combination of mental illness, severe or not, addiction and disaffiliation. Several young men I interviewed were from the area with living, housed parents. They implied that they were on the street because of some combination of addiction and estrangement from their loved ones. Consider a young man who appeared to be in his early 20s named Daniel. While walking to work one morning, I came across his body stretched out in front of the laundromat. His sleeping bag looked expensive and new. His boots looked of similarly good quality, and were sitting 5 feet away from him on the sidewalk, an empty can of tuna fish, plastic wrappers from chips, and used beverage containers scattered around him. When I woke him up to ask if he was okay, he said he was. He looked fit and strong and in much better shape than the older homeless men and women around our office, like Stephen, whom I first met after he had passed out, face down, his pants down around his knees in front of our retail office. Stephen is from Ohio, but has been here for nearly 2 decades. He has few, if any, teeth, and spends his days drinking alcohol while playing a video game on his smartphone. The two men are utterly different. Does it really make sense to lump them into a single category called homeless? Neither Stephen nor Daniel is a single mother seeking shelter and a restraining order against an abusive husband, and yet all are categorized as homeless or as unhoused. But as we have seen, such labeling stemmed from an advocacy effort aimed at convincing us that the problem is poverty and the solution is spending more money on housing and services for the homeless and not, say, shelter and abstinence-contingent housing. One word, homeless, entails an entire insidious discourse that acts unconsciously and subliminally on our hearts and minds, rendering us unable to understand the reality before us. Perhaps the most tragic and harmful work done by the word homeless is the mixing together of people with severe mental illness with people like Daniel and Stephen, neither of whom suffer from any mental illness remotely as severe as the ones from which the two women who often wander past my office suffer. I have seen each over 12 times in the last year, and every time they were in a psychotic or distressed state. One screams accusations of rape and molestation, randomly at passers-by. The other one, missing most of her teeth, rants incoherently at invisible beings. Once, while leaving work at dusk and locking the door, I had the feeling of being watched. With my hand still on the key, I slowly turned my head 45 degrees to my left to look behind me. The woman was by a trash can, about 20 feet from me, staring at me intently with a big open-mouthed smile. As our eyes locked, she started laughing in a way that sent chills down my back. I do not spook easily. I've traveled through war zones since the late 1980s, been robbed at gunpoint, and worked and lived in dangerous neighborhoods for 30 years. I believe it is possible to be safe in dangerous places if you have a good idea about what you can expect. But by the spring of 2021, more and more people whom I encountered on the street frightened me due to their unpredictably aggressive behaviors. In 1 week in February, 3 psychotic people in separate incidents lunged at me. One man came running and yelling at me from the inside of a darkened garage as I walked along the sidewalk, distracted by a phone conversation after work. I involuntarily reacted, turning around and shouting back, "Jesus!" instantly causing the man to himself startle and say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," in a desperate and pathetic voice. Rattled and my heart booming, I said, "Okay, okay, it's okay, it's okay," before walking quickly away. In the spring of 2021, 2 colleagues and I went to San Francisco. We first went to check in on the open-air drug scenes in the Tenderloin and United Nations Plaza. It was the usual scenes of people sitting against buildings and injecting drug needles into their necks and feet. There was garbage, old food, and feces everywhere. After a couple of hours, we decided to go out to eat in the Mission. Work was over. We were all looking forward to a relaxing dinner. We were eating ice cream and walking along Valencia Street when a psychotic man, perhaps about 30 years old, began following us and screaming obscenities. When we turned around to look at him, he screamed at us, "What are you looking for, huh? What are you looking for?" and started walking faster toward us. We walked faster until the man found other people to verbally assault. I have no unusual fear of mentally ill people and have long felt compassion toward them. My aunt suffered schizophrenia, and at an early age, my parents, who are psychologists, explained mental illness to me. I did not spend a great deal of time with her, but the strongest memory I have of her is positive. She spoiled us like an aunt often does. taking us to McDonald's and giving us M&Ms, which she called pills. I remember her face being heavily painted with makeup in shades of red and green. She was slightly scary, but I could tell that she treasured her time with us, and I cared and worried about her. But it is also clear that untreated mental illness and addiction in progressive West Coast cities has gone well beyond being degrading to the people suffering from it, and dehumanizing to everyone who witnesses it, to also being a threat to public safety and order. I asked Daniel if I could help him find help, and he declined. He told me he was from Pittsburgh, a middle-class city of 71,000 people, about 40 miles from San Francisco. He implied that he was estranged from his parents. I asked him if his parents loved him, and he said they did. I told him that, as a parent, I would be worried sick about him, especially if I knew he had spent the night on such a dangerous street, his boots on the sidewalk, and trash strewn about him. I asked him if he believed in God, and he said he did. I told Daniel that God loves him and that I believed he wanted Daniel to live his life to his potential and not stay on the streets or on drugs. According to the homelessness discourse, I should not have said any of this, because it was embarrassing to Daniel. But shouldn't Daniel feel embarrassed waking up in a sleeping bag on the sidewalk? The question might make us uncomfortable. Just like compassion, shame can be abused to manipulate others, or make them feel inferior for things they shouldn't feel ashamed of, such as mental illness. But shame is essential to enforcing social norms, from picking up after your dog, to not being intoxicated in public, to not sleeping on sidewalks with your personal belongings and trash strewn about, without the use of law enforcement or incarceration. Many would say Daniel should not feel shame because he is homeless and thus by definition a victim. But just as people who can't feel pain accidentally injure themselves, Daniel will suffer mentally and socially if he isn't allowed to feel shame. And he will suffer if he does not value the things that make our lives meaningful, honest, and fulfilling. The function of pain is to prevent us from damaging our own tissue, says one psychologist. The function of shame is to prevent us from damaging our social relationships, or to motivate us to repair them. It's not a matter of whether we will shame, but what we will shame. Progressives preaching the gospel of victimology have nothing against shame. They just shame and value different behaviors than others. Consider if I had said, "We must have compassion for Daniel. Imagine what he might have suffered at home to lead him to risk his life sleeping on the street. How lucky we should feel to not share his fate. And yet any of us could at any moment end up just like him. Either way, anyone who does not have compassion for Daniel is contributing to his victimization." Saying all of that is shaming those who might see things differently. Consider if you had asked in response, "But why was Daniel really out there? How do we know he wasn't just a spoiled boy who had partied too hard the night before? And what about the rights of the people who live and work nearby?" I could have said, "How dare you, a person who lives in a fine home and who enjoys drinking alcohol, judge Daniel? You don't know what he's been through. He could be a victim of molestation. He could be mentally ill. And what, now you want to throw him in jail, which will destroy his life, or make him sleep in a shelter where he could be victimized further? Why don't you help him instead? See what he needs." Such moralizing, which involves both valuing and shaming, is usually all that is required to shut up anyone seeking to defend the right of city people to enjoy clean, safe, and orderly shared spaces from sidewalks to parks. These internal conflicts happen because seeing someone in a deplorable state inspires uncomfortable feelings. It's normal for shame to arise when we experience the moral dilemmas, both for him and ourselves, around Daniel's situation. But rather than thinking through those dilemmas, progressives have normalized people's aberrant behavior in their fights to first decriminalize and then destigmatize behaviors that that are incompatible with city life. It's not necessarily illegal, after all, for chronically inebriated people to stare at me, scream at me, and scare me. It might be if they can be viewed as threatening me with violence. But simply saying, "I'm sorry," implies it was accidental, particularly to the progressive judges and juries of San Francisco. Part of the power of the progressive discourse around homelessness is how it has constantly pushed the limits of existing laws to allow for behaviors that are incompatible with civilization. Recall that the ACLU defends the right of floridly psychotic people to break the law because they are too mentally ill to be responsible for their actions, but not mentally ill enough to be hospitalized. When streets, parks, and entire neighborhoods are dominated by homeless encampments and open-air drug scenes, they become frightening, inhospitable, and dangerous. Nobody is proposing to prioritize the enforcement of drug laws against people who want to drink alcohol, smoke marijuana, and even inject fentanyl and meth in the privacy of their homes, causing no harm to others. But when camping on sidewalks, public defecation, and public drug use are permitted, they undermine the safety and thus the freedom of others. The antidote to the misleading homelessness discourse is to use specific words that refer to people in the real world, which is more accurate and more humanizing. Many people on the street are disaffiliated, unemployed, alienated from their parents, and suffering from addiction and mental illness. We do not need the same policy for a mother of two toddlers escaping domestic violence as we do for Daniel, Stephen, or the two psychotic women on the streets near my office. Conflating all these people under one definition of homelessness makes it harder to create policies that will help any of them. We must train ourselves to be alert for misinformation and manipulations of our emotions, including compassion, anger, and shame. The homelessness discourse preys on the public's ignorance of the issues, rising sympathy, and compassion in an increasingly secular society, and the emotional distancing that many people engage in to avoid disturbing information. But many of the core premises of the homelessness discourse are misleading and false, as we have seen. Gaining mastery of the facts is essential to gaining mastery over our thinking and feelings. Foucault's ideas simultaneously weakened and strengthened the progressive commitment to victimology. On the one hand, Foucault rejected reductionism and essentialism, the idea that complex individual people could or should be reduced to a single and supposedly essential trait, like race, gender, religion, or sexual orientation. In his last major book, History of Sexuality, Foucault argued that our sexuality is produced or socially constructed and doesn't exist purely biologically. I believe that the term gay has become obsolete, and indeed all such terms denoting a specific sexual orientation, said Foucault in 1975. Just because someone was attracted to someone of the same sex did not make them gay, felt Foucault, and labeling people in such ways was oppressive. On the other, Foucault argued that any attempt to free ourselves from powerful forces would require other powerful forces that would ensnare us in new ways, no matter our intentions. We were helpless to do anything other than tear down the old institutions and categories. Foucault was thus, in an important sense, encouraging his readers to deliberately limit their political engagement to negative, critical, and destructive actions, namely attacking social norms and civic institutions. And yet, as we have seen, progressives have insisted that it wasn't them, it was Reagan and Republicans, who are responsible for closing the psychiatric hospitals without creating a viable replacement. Out of the view that inequality is by definition proof of racism and other forms of victimization, progressives in recent years have turned their sights on public schools, particularly ones that still decide student admissions based on merit rather than a lottery. In February 2021, the San Francisco School Board voted to replace merit-based admissions to its most elite high school, Lowell, with a lottery system. The then-vice president of the school board said, "Meritocracy based on standardized testing, I am just going to say it, those are racist systems." In March 2021, activists in New York filed a lawsuit calling for an end to merit-based admissions to its elite high schools, Stuyvesant High and Bronx Science, because, they said, the meritocratic system of admissions testing perpetuates racism and segregation. But the progressive board members presented no evidence that they are caused by racism. Rather, they simply pointed to the racial disparities in admissions as proof of bias. During the 2020-21 academic year, Asians, whites, Latinos, and African Americans constituted 42, 25, 13, and 2% of freshmen at Lowell. It is hard not to consider the San Francisco School Board's actions in the context of the city's failure to meaningfully narrow the achievement gap between white, black, and Latino students. Where 69% of San Francisco's white students were proficient in math, just 14% and 22% of its black and Latino students were. As such, the school board may have been using Lowell, consciously or unconsciously, as a scapegoat for the broader societal, parenting, and schooling failures that had allowed racial disparities of this magnitude to persist. Many San Francisco parents were infuriated by the contrast between the haste with which the board took its action and its relaxed attitude toward resuming in-person classes for children during the pandemic. So too was San Francisco Mayor London Breed. "What I cannot understand," she said, "is why the school board is advancing a plan to have all these schools renamed by April, when there isn't a plan to have our kids back in the classroom by then." Amid the furor, Lowell supporters unearthed a series of tweets written in 2016 by the school board's vice president, who had called Lowell's merit-based admissions racist. "Asians used white supremacist thinking to assimilate and get ahead," she claimed in one of them. "Where are the vocal Asians speaking up against Trump? Don't Asian Americans know they're on his list as well? Do they think they won't be deported, profiled, beaten? Being a house N-word is still being an N-word. You're still considered the help." In other words, she was upset that Asians didn't recognize that their race and society's racism make them victims, no matter how successful they are. Her comments upset Tom Wolf. "Both of her kids are in a merit-based private school in San Francisco," he said, pointing me to a tweet she wrote referencing the exclusive private school to which she sends her daughters. "My kids are in virtual public school and they're struggling," said Tom. Nearly two dozen San Francisco elected officials, including Mayor Breed, called on the school board's vice president to resign her position and demanded that the board return San Francisco's public school children to in-class learning as soon as possible. Tom was also bothered by the anti-Asian remarks. "It's really toxic," he said. "My wife is Filipino and my kids are biracial. San Francisco is just really sick right now."